College offers continuing studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And for this portion of today's morning show here on WGTD, we are going back into the morning show archives all the way back to 2003 for one of my all-time favorite interviews with a psychotherapist by the name of Janet Malamud Smith. And we are talking about a book called A Potent Spell, Mother Love and the Power of Fear. In this book, Janet Malamud Smith explores the phenomenon of parents and particularly mothers who parent with an overarching sense of fear and even dread that something truly terrible might happen to their child. It is the contention of Janet Malamud Smith that this fear, which of course is based in reality, can sometimes go way too far, and that fear is stoked by an entire industry that exists and in a sense preys upon the vulnerabilities of parents and their fear that something might happen to their precious children. She also contends that this is something that has gone on for a long, long time. And she offers all kinds of helpful suggestions in her book about how parents can be respectful of such realities and mindful of them without allowing such fears to, in a sense, overrun common sense and ultimately be counterproductive in all kinds of different ways. The book, again, is called A Potent Spell, Mother Love and the Power of Fear.
Janet Malamud Smith, you are a mother of two sons, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
And tell me, first of all, the intersection between your own real life, your own personal experience as a mother, with this topic that you were examining. To what extent did you allow your own life and experience to have any bearing on this particular work?
Oh, it had so much bearing. First of all, I have a sort of theory that nonfiction books are always answers that writers hold secretly inside them, no matter how far the real topic is. But this one was really close to me. When my sons were born, I was staggered by how much it turned my life on its head. I hadn't expected, I'd expected to love them and stuff, but I hadn't expected to suddenly find my whole world revolving around the access of their safety and well-being. And so the degree to which that compelled me really became the center of this book. And I wanted to understand both whether what I was feeling was something that a lot of other mothers felt, which of course it was, and what it meant to be so consumed with my children's safety. And then I began to explore and try and understand what it meant in larger ways that mothers so usually put their children first. I don't mean that mothers are angels or mothers are wonderful, but that once a mother attaches to a child, she will sort of tie herself into pretzels trying to keep that child safe. And that's what the book explores.
Well, and then you want to examine then, as you say it, how this maybe unconsidered determinant of women's history has worked. That the way that women have lived out their lives, what they have accomplished or not accomplished beyond parenthood, perhaps has something to do with this.
Exactly. And one of the things that just sort of took me over as I was doing research for the book, and I've spent a lot of my life reading history and looking at the past in different ways, but one of the things that took me over was the question of why is it that in most of the world today, mothers are still doing more hours of work for less compensation, don't get as good nutrition in poor countries as husbands, for example, or men, are unequal on almost every scale that we can measure in, and why has this been the norm since the beginning of time, and why have we been so slow to think about issues of making mothers equal citizens in any society. I mean, even in America, you know, it's maybe 100 years since we've had adequate birth control, 100 years since we've let women into colleges, less than 100 years since we've allowed women the vote. So why is this such a slow-growing thing? And as I began to think about this, I realized it came together with this the intensity of what I call the mother's alarm system and this compulsion to put children first. And I felt these two phenomena were related. And the book is really an exploration of that relationship.
One of the pictures that you draw, we should hasten to add that one of the best things about this book is that you take us back into history and Greek drama and to early child care manuals and so on. But to me, one of the most enduring pictures from this book is a very simple and contemporary one. You tell us or paint for us the picture of a pregnant woman with a couple of young kids in tow crossing the street, and you talk about how in trying to do that and keeping everybody together, she is hobbled, and you draw such a beautiful parallel between that and what life can be for a mother who is contending with all of the challenges of being a good mother.
That's right. You've said it so well, and I think that the woman, if you imagine that mom who's pregnant with a toddler in each hand trying to cross the street, it was a metaphor I used to try and capture succinctly the amount of vulnerability that you have when all of a sudden you're looking after a colony instead of simply yourself, and what it means to try and move a group or protect a group or think for a group or feed a group, and how profoundly that changes you when suddenly it's not just about you. And it's exactly that image that sort of captures why I think it is that mothers have remained in such an unequal position. May I tell you another mother's story that's
yes.
in the book? One of my favorites was told to me. One of the great things about writing this book was that mothers just started telling me stories when I would tell them what I was writing about. And this was a woman who was well into her 60s, and her son was grown and came home one day as a 25-year-old with a friend of his. And the mom and dad had just in their retirement or that phase of life bought a motorboat. And the son decided that he wanted to go out into the ocean with the motorboat. And so, not feeling she could stop him, because that seemed the wrong thing to do to a 25-year-old, she said, okay. And she let them go, and, you know, she went about her day, but she realized that in the back of her mind, every second she was going, okay, how much gas is in the gas tank? Do they have the charts of the bay? Do they know what the riptide does? Do they know when the high tide comes? Do they know when the low tide comes? Well, what about those rocks over in the corner? And the kids didn't come back, and it got darker and darker and later, and her husband went to sleep, and she was just fretting and fretting and fretting. So finally she took a flashlight. She walked across her yard down to the dock, walked out on the dock at about 10 at night, and stood there with the flashlight on over her head, making herself into a beacon to help her boy and his friend come home. Now, they made it safely, but this is the other image that I think so captures what I'm trying to talk about in the book, about what a mom will do and how silly we all feel sometimes to the extent we'll go to create the safety for our children.
You mentioned at one point that the passion we feel towards infants, children's adolescence, defies reason and every imposed idea about how it ought to be. The idea that we're not talking necessarily about a reasonable feeling, but an unreasonable feeling.
Precisely. We're talking about an alarm system, I think, that's so deeply in us, that is so at the heart of who we are as people and as mothers, that it sometimes triggers and acts and carries us into feeling states and action before we even know that our buttons have been pushed.
One of the really intriguing, I don't want to call it a contradiction, but one of the sort of, I don't know, factual rubs, let's say, is that, of course, once upon a time, infant mortality was tragically high all over the world, and increasingly, at least in the United States, we can give thanks that infants do not perish at the rate that they once did, and that by and large, our children are much safer than they once were. Their real safety is indeed improved. But you go on to say then that despite this, mothers do not seem to be any more at ease than they once were. And you cite, I think, three different basic reasons why mothers continue to live their lives as mothers with such a heightened sense of fear. Let's talk about what those three factors are.
Well, I'm honestly not positive which three you're referring to, but let me tell you the ones that come to my mind now, and maybe you can fill in the one I missed.
Sure.
The first thing is that just staggered me when I wrote the book, and I started really looking at infant mortality and child mortality, and also infant and child abandonment, which is another whole amazing phenomenon in history. But what I discovered that was just incredible was that when infant mortality dramatically goes down in the United States right at the end of the 19th century, mostly not through improvements of medicine, but because we've managed to learn to cover the sewers, though, of course, medicine and nutrition play into it eventually as well. But the second that the infant and child mortality go down, without losing a beat, the people who give advice to mothers, all the people who write the advice books that I ended up reading, change over from threatening mothers with the death of children, which has been the norm in advice books up to then, to threatening them with the psychological maiming of children if they don't do a good enough job. So one of the reasons that mothers get no relief is because the public voices that are advising mothers do not say, gee, this is great, look how much safer you guys have, your kids are. You moms go out and have a good time and go earn a living and have fun with your friends. Instead, the advice givers say, oh, yeah, we've saved some lives now, but moms, watch out. If you love your kid even a little bit wrong, you're going to destroy them for life.
Yes, you can do still better.
That's right. So that's one reason. A second reason that I point to is when I read a lot of contemporary mother's advice magazines in America Today and the advice books, one of the things I noticed was that there was this phenomenal and really quite absurd, even though I don't think you notice it as absurd when you have a young child, hyping of dangers that are just in the level of the ridiculous. But I think, for example, watch out what pogo stick you buy. Some of the springs might hurt your kid. Or an advice guide that says, oh, God, if your child gets a puncture wound to his brain, don't forget to take him to a doctor. It could make a terrible infection. This kind of sort of gratuitous advice that ends up serving as a system of scaring mothers way beyond, I think, what's useful. And I think that it isn't, however paranoid you might be tempted to be, it isn't because people really set out to scare moms. It's that they know that this stuff sells, that people will read material about dangers in a way that they'll buy and read almost nothing else. So we unintentionally end up creating an aura of fear.
I love the way you put this in the chapter entitled Worrying Mothers. In talking about media message, you say, there are no boundaries on the universe a mother must monitor. You know, danger is at every hand. And in fact, you talk about how mothers, when we elevate them onto a pedestal, you talk about how there's something like there's 360 degrees directions in which a mother can fall off that pedestal.
No, that's right. And I think you put your finger on the third reason, thank you, that one of the things that happens in the world of motherhood is that in the 19th century, when men begin to work out of the home, all of a sudden you get this cult of idealized motherhood. Now, a lot of people have written about it, but what's really important about it is that it is created out of whole cloth. It has no relationship to what a real mom could really do. And so if you start reading advice guides, say, in the 1830s in America, all of a sudden you get this message that says, you know what, George Washington was the greatest hero America ever had because his mother was so wonderful. And by the way, Lord Byron was the most sinful, scandalous poet ever alive in England because his mom was a decadent creep. So you get this aligning of what happens to sons with how moms behave. And what becomes so important about this is that the world of psychology and psychoanalysis, when it comes into its own in the maybe 80 or 100 years later, takes this mythology as fact. And it tries to create a social science around this gibberish about how the mom made it happen. And so the third reason that even though infant mortality disappears, moms don't feel a whole lot better is because we've created a fabric of myths about how much damage and good a mom can do, which is way above and beyond anything that's really possible.
Right. You also go on to say in kind of a related matter that in our current age that mothers are are asked to love their child in exactly the right way. You say, with an optimally attuned love, correctly attached love, not selfish love or anxious love or passionate love or critical love, a perfect love in which all these different things are supposed to be balanced just right. And you say, the impossibility of satisfying such a mandate makes many mothers feel unsure and inadequate. And little wonder.
No, you're right. And one of the funny things for me when I was talking with mothers, sort of sad and poignant, was that a mom would say to me, so what's this book about? And I'd start to tell her, and she'd say, is it going to make me feel worse? And I think that my mom feels so criticized because it's as if, I mean, think about sort of witchcraft for a minute, or the witch trials in New England, that when the Salem witches were put on trial, the criteria by which they were charged were absolutely impossible for anybody to talk their way out of. You know, we saw you walking in this funny way, or you're accused of things that you cannot, against which you can't defend yourself. And I think moms feel put in that same position in this culture, and I think they are. I think that because of the way we've popularized psychology and notions of mother damage, every mom feels that she can be accused in a million ways of failing in love.
Yes, of being either too protective or of being negligent,
exactly,
or someplace in between.
Or too this or too that. Or, you know, I mean, everybody has their complaint. And I think part of the problem is we probably put a lot too much emphasis on love as a cure-all in our culture. And certainly, you know, the sad thing is that many other variables affect how children do in the world. You know, what neighborhood they were born into, what public school or private school they go to, what genetic endowment for illnesses they have, millions of things. It's wonderful if we can love our children, but it isn't the only thing, and we make it the only thing in our public discourse. And I think this does terrible damage to mom.
That brings to mind another factor, which you mentioned, the fact that, of course, the majority of contemporary women are either working outside the home or in other ways are very active outside the home, but many of them do so with this sort of gnawing sense that they maybe shouldn't be. You quote quite an article from the National Review by a Richard Lowry, who really lays into to women who drop off their children in daycare. What I think is interesting, I mean, I think we've all heard that perspective shared, and, you know, some of our listeners might even agree with it. But I think the point that you make that is so insightful is when you say that working mother's escalated guilt might have more negative effect on their children than the fact that she's working and away from the home.
No, I think that's right. And I think that if you imagine for a minute a mom who comes home from work, whether she's there because she wants to be working or because she has to be working, but she feels, oh, God, I'm a bad mom because I'm working. And the child says it at 8 o'clock at night when it's bedtime, oh, Mommy, you know, you can't put me to bed. You've been gone all day. I should be able to stay up two more hours. Well, a mom who feels guilty and that, you know, that she's really already failed for not being there, it's much harder for her to put that to rest and say, you know what, you need to go to bed, because the child has found a way to press the same button that the society is pressing. And it's not terribly wonderful for kids when we start dealing with them out of our guilt.
Right. You say children are brilliant at sensing parental uncertainty, self-doubt, or ambivalence, and I have a feeling you are not overstating that.
No, that's right. I think this is one of the many things my own sons taught me. You know, if a child comes to you at 3 in the afternoon and says, can I have an ice cream cone? And you say, oh, yeah, fine, 3 in the afternoon, that's fine. If they come to you at 5:30 in the evening and they say, can I have an ice cream cone? You think to yourself, maybe dinner, maybe not. No. But they instantly hear your uncertainty. So that instead of saying, all right, they say, oh, Mom, I'm starving. I mean, they know how to push on any bit of uncertainty that you have. And, of course, what's modern life but endless uncertainty?
You also mentioned the fact that contemporary demographics have something to do with the anxiety that grips so many mothers. The fact that more and more Americans have grown up in smaller families,
yes,
meaning, well, at one point, for instance, you say so many adult children grow up only with the experience of having received, not given, child care.
Exactly. Isn't that, It is sort of amazing when you think about it. Probably until, you know, our generation or the one just before it, it was very unusual for a child to grow up in a family without enough siblings and enough demands on them to help raise the siblings, that by the time they would grow up, they would know, you know, a fair amount firsthand about young children. And that's completely disappeared. So when our kids were born, my husband and I thought we were receiving alien creatures from another planet. We were so anxious by the strangeness of what an infant was that it took us a long time to calm down enough to just raise it. And that was by no means our experience alone. I mean, I think that's a very common phenomenon now and probably has its good news and its bad news in it. But, of course, the other piece of it is that whereas in the past, every family had child loss, just about. It was the exceptional family that didn't lose a child in many, many moments in history. They also had a number of children oftentimes, so that if a child died, at least there was another. And we're getting to a point now where that isn't true for many families.
Yes, the loss of a child in some way will have almost a more sweeping effect. You also talk about the fact that because children are now much more likely to survive than in years past, you say that there is less open communal expectation of child loss and less support for enduring it. A very interesting observation. What exactly are you saying there?
I think that in my work as a psychotherapist, one of the things that I really have learned across the last 20 years is that when parents lose children now, they are bereaved in a way that is just devastating. And part of that bereavement is their individual loss of their child. But part of it is that they feel that, why me? This has not happened to anybody else. No one else understands. Why was I singled out for this? So whereas in the past, at least there was the comfort of knowing that every other person in your town and village or city had lived through what you had lived through, now people feel like pariahs of a certain kind, as if they've been singled out for this terrible, terrible kind of misfortune.
We're talking with Jana Malamud-Smith. She is the author of a book entitled A Potent Spell, Mother Love and the Power of Fear. Jana Malamud-Smith, one thing that is so compelling about this book is that you have taken a long time to search out much that has been written about motherhood over the centuries, actually. And very interesting, much of what you find, including all the way back to Greek drama. If you don't mind, I would rather focus, however, in the few minutes that remain, on some of the American writings a little closer to our own history, dating from the 1600s and 1700s. Some of what is written is just incredible.
Isn't it? It really is. Maybe we should just start with my favorite, the first book that I talk about. And what I try to do is talk about only a few books so that readers aren't overwhelmed by huge numbers of books, but to pick out ones that I think are typical. And in 1674, an English minister named John Flavel published a book which was an advice guide for a mother telling her how to mourn the death of her only son, which just is staggering to me as a book topic. From that era, since advice guides were only just beginning. And this book sold very well, and I was able to take a look closely in the book at how well it sold in Boston and New England. It was sort of remarkable. It stayed in print for 120 years.
Which, wow.
Usually now a book stays in print for a year or two, so that tells us a lot. But in it, the minister tells the mothers, you know, gives them different pointers on how to grieve a dead child. But one of the things that just jumps out at you is at one point he says, you know, maybe it's your own fault your child died.
Mm. He says, the minister urges readers to look for unseen causes, to examine their own impieties.
Exactly, and particularly, maybe you loved your son too much. Can you imagine? I mean, so that the poor grieving mother, on top of everything else, has to feel terrible that she loved and adored this child. And the minister implies that maybe you love the child more than you love God, and God got jealous and had to teach you a lesson. I mean, and, you know, to add this to the burden of loss, and what I learned in reading these advice guides, and the reason I started with John Flavel, is that he becomes a template for what happens later, that when advice guides start to be written first by doctors and then by psychologists, even though all the information changes, the process of blaming mothers and threatening them for their own children's death does not change.
Right.
It just takes new forms.
Yes. From about the same era, you quote a book which sounds equally fascinating called A Token for Children by James Janeway.
Yes, this was a phenomenal bestseller in England and America, and it was a book to be read by children about, and mothers often read it, about the death of children. You know, in those days, in the Puritans particularly, used to say these horrendous things to children. They would say, you know, you're likely not to grow up. You're very likely to die. They might say to a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old, as an effort to get them to be more devout in the hopes of saving their souls. But what the book is, A Token for Children, is a series of stories about children dying and how they find faith in the process, but also about how much the mothers get chastised when they grieve their children.
Right. You say there that the way these stories are told, that the good children are often presented as being much wiser than their mothers.
Exactly. You know, the children end up saying to their mothers, oh, you can let me go. Don't grieve over me. I mean, it's heartbreaking material, but it also focuses again on the potency of this potent spell I write about, the way in which everybody recognizes that maternal attachment is a thing unto itself.
In the next chapter, you kind of take us into the next generation of books written, and they seem to be more and more written specifically with mothers in mind. And one of the points that you make in this chapter, as you quote you know, some really unbelievable things, you say that authoritative writing about child rearing apparently required little personal experience. You cite that over and over again.
Right. One of the scary things you learn reading mother advice guides is almost none of them were written by people who'd actually mothered children. And so it seemed as if the freedom to have a strong opinion was in inverse proportion to what you really had a hands-on experience.
I have to quote one of the things you quote in the book where, oh, now I'm not going to be able to find it, but you quote one of these advice guides. Here it is, where the author, I don't remember which book this is, I think it's a book by someone named Watson, and they are talking about what temperature the bathwater should be.
Yeah, so this is Holt's book on children, yeah.
Oh, okay, the care and feeding of children.
Yes.
And and the answer to that question, at what temperature should the bath be given? For the first few weeks, at 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Later, during early infancies, at 98 degrees Fahrenheit. After 6 months, at 95 degrees Fahrenheit. During the second year, from 85 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, this is being passed off as though it is science, as though it makes even a little bit of sense.
Right. Right. And, you know, I think that this was an era when the doctors were trying very much to establish their authority and to say that there was a scientific answer to raising infants. And if moms just obeyed the scientists, they'd get it right. Well, they had to develop all this mishmash of pseudoscience in order to have something to tell moms. And then, in fact, what's interesting about the text you just quoted, too, is that it then gets translated into psychology very quickly. Whereas immediately Watson comes along and sees that Holt has written a bestseller and tries to do the same thing in psychology, and his outcome is even more horrendous. Hmm.
You go on to give some advice to mothers, and you state really unequivocally that the best thing that a mother can give to a child, or the thing that a child needs more than anything, is a mother that, well, at first you might say free and happy, but especially that a mother is free, that a mother is not so weighed down by these kind of irrational fears and concerns that they cannot themselves be a vibrant, healthy human being.
That's right. And what I think I feel is, first of all, in any detailed way, I feel lucky when I match my socks in the morning, so I don't have a lot of on-high wisdom for moms. But what I really am trying to say to the culture is, look, children take their lead from how parents live their lives and view the world. And a mom who has been put inside the four walls of a room and told she can't go out in the world, she can't be a public citizen, she can't explore her own potential and contribute to her community and live her own life, whether she works at a day job or works at primarily at home, but a mother who is constricted is going to offer a constricted worldview to her children. Because the world you see for yourself is the world that you give to your offspring. So it behooves us. It is really our responsibility in this world to do whatever we can to liberate and offer opportunity to all its citizens, but to remember that that goes for mothers as well as everyone else.
You say in the book that mothers have their fears continually refreshed. At that moment in the book you're talking about, you know, all that you read in Good Housekeeping or whatever the magazine might be, or in all these other ways, plus this whole history, this whole legacy of what mothers have been told down through the generations. What is your advice to a mother to help her escape that cycle of having her fears refreshed over and over again?
One of the reasons I wrote the book, one of the things I most hoped for in writing the book, was to comfort mothers and to tell them they weren't alone. And I think the only advice I really have is that if all of us as mothers begin to understand how deeply ruled we are by these feelings of putting children first and keeping them safe, maybe we can begin to hold them a little bit differently and get some perspective on them so that we also can continue to make other choices in our lives that let us care for our children and let us live in the world.
Janet Malamud-Smith's book, once again, is called A Potent Spell, Mother Love and the Power of Fear. This interview first aired back in 2003. And to finish out today's morning show, we have some thoughts on fathers, fathering, and fatherhood from Dan Gettleman, very well known to public radio listeners, who, among other things, was responsible for reviving a radio program that had first been heard in the early 1950s on CBS. This, I Believe, created by Edward R. Murrow. Dan Gettleman brought back This, I Believe, and it still exists as a very popular podcast, and it has spawned a number of different books, including the one at hand, This, I Believe, on Fatherhood, a lovely collection of remarkable essays talking about fathers, fatherhood, and even a few that talk about fathering when it does not occur with the actual father, but somebody who fulfills that very important role in a child's life. This collection of essays includes a really beautiful essay by a writer from Wisconsin.
His name is Eric Larson. He's from Waukesha. Did I pronounce that right?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. From Waukesha, and he writes a wonderful essay. It's called The Cards Will Hear You. The cards meaning playing cards. And it's really a perfect example of an essay from this book in that it focuses both on what he learned from his father in playing cards and sort of the card playing as a metaphor for life, that you should be a good sport. You should lose well. You should win well. You should enjoy it while you're doing it and not just focus on the outcome of the hand or the game or the match or whatever. And then he's taken this as both kind of a life philosophy that he's put into use throughout his life, but also very specifically as a parenting philosophy to try to instill that same concept into his children so that they're not so focused on the end result of whatever it is they're doing and sort of enjoy the ride, regardless of the outcome.
I wonder if you happen to remember what's my favorite moment in that essay, which is really about tackling life with a positive spirit. And, of course, we've heard that a lot. I mean, sometimes it's one of the last things we feel like hearing about yet again.
Right.
But boy, when somebody puts it as well as Mr. Larson does, it's worth reading. My favorite part of that essay is when he talks about visiting his 89-year-old great-great-uncle.
Yes.
Do you remember this exchange?
Yeah, his great-great-uncle is in the hospital recovering from a stroke, and he gives him this vice grip handshake, and says, "Hey, not too bad for an old man," just sort of the antithesis of what you expect a frail elderly person who's probably in their last few months to do. It's a wonderful moment.
Yeah, he finishes that talking about that by saying he would not be defeated by a stroke or old age.
That's right.
This was no deathbed.
That's exactly right.
We're speaking with Dan Gettleman. We are talking about the most recent book to be published out of the essay series This I Believe, this book called This I Believe on Fatherhood. Mr. Gettleman, before we talk about a couple other really notable essays in this wonderful book. I wonder if you could just say a word in general about how, and maybe you, maybe the answer is you don't particularly know the answer to this question, but I am very curious to know, if you know, how these essays typically take shape. I mean, in many cases, we're talking about people who do not write for a living and maybe are trying to do this for the first time in their lives. And, of course, in other cases, we are talking about people who are skilled writers and experienced writers, but nevertheless, it's a very personal sort of expression. But do you ever get any kind of notion of under what circumstances or over what sort of timeline these essays tend to sort of take shape?
Sure. You know, it's funny. As you called me for this interview, I was staring at a postcard that I have on my desk from John Updike, who wrote an essay for us back in 2005. And Updike told us that it was the most difficult writing exercise or writing assignment he'd ever been given, in that it's, on the one hand, open-ended, right? He's not writing about a particular topic that someone tells him to write about, but he has a very limited space to write it, 500 words. And so he had a very difficult time doing it, and as a matter of fact, he really didn't follow the directions. You're supposed to, the essence of what makes a This I Believe essay a This I Believe essay is that it is written from the first-person perspective. It's not proscriptive. Here's what you ought to think. This is, or you ought to believe. It's what I believe. That it focuses on a single belief, and that it tells the story behind that belief. Where did it come from? Who inspired it, or what experience inspired it? Did you used to have a differing belief, and then it changed somehow because of some event? Or perhaps it was this a belief that you had, you know, sort of in theory earlier in life, and then you had some experience that galvanized it and really strengthened it. And so Mr. Updike kind of cheated and wrote his essay about three different things. So people tell us it's very difficult. There's another essayist in this book, in the This I Believe on Fatherhood book, who is a writer by trade and has written several novels, and he said that writing his This I Believe essay took him longer than all the other books he had written put together. It took him 18 months to write his essay. He kept writing new drafts, and he'd come up, you know, with a new idea, and then he'd start again. So some people find it really difficult. But then other people tell us, we've had several people with variations of the same story, which is that they heard one of our essay segments on public radio, and they had one of these, like, driveway moments, or in one case, a freeway moment, where essentially this guy was driving home from work, and he was, you know, inspired by what he heard on NPR, and he decided to write his own essay. So he did it on his, like, BlackBerry in between red lights. You know, whenever he got to a red light, he'd jot down some more notes, and then he'd drive a little bit and then get to his next red light and write some more. And so he composed his essay, or at least the first draft of his essay, with his thumbs on his BlackBerry in traffic.
One of the things I was struck by as I read through this intriguing book, and you touched on this matter in one of the first things you said in our interview, is the fact that when we are talking about fathers and fatherhood and how we are affected by our fathers, that sometimes that can be a very inspiring, gratifying, wonderful, life-affirming story, and that in other cases, fatherhood can be sadly about something else.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be among the harshest lessons that we are taught. I wonder if you could just speak a word about that reality.
Sure.
And how that influenced the shaping of this book and which essays you chose to share with the public in this fashion.
Sure. Well, you know, we gave this a lot of thought because, you know, there's an awful lot of people out there who have had very conflicted or challenging relationships with their fathers. And I dare say there are a lot of fathers out there who have had very conflicted relationships with their children. It's a relationship by its nature where there's a lot of expectations built into it on both sides, meaning, you know, kids expect their parents to be a certain way, to be invincible, to never make mistakes, to always be wise and, you know, never let them down, that sort of thing. And then on the other side, of course, you have parents who have very high expectations of their children, drive them hard or upset when they don't get A's on their report cards or, you know, don't win at whatever sports, you know, whatever sporting event they're participating in. So there's a lot of essays. I won't say a lot. There are a handful of essays in the book that look at that more those more challenging parts of the parenting relationship between fathers and children. There's one in particular in the book that we felt, you know, compelled to include because it, again, is a very real-world experience, and that is where the father is an alcoholic or drug addict and was impaired as a father and not able to, you know, fully participate in the child's life and or was abusive or, you know, abandoned the family, whatnot. And it's a beautiful essay in the book from a man who writes about how he was just filled with vitriol toward his father throughout his childhood and adolescence and adulthood because his father was an alcoholic and not a very reliable father, to say the least. And then he had his own child. And somehow he had this epiphany looking at his child in the crib and feeling this enormous outpouring of love for his child. And he thought, you know, as bad as my dad was, he must have gazed upon me in the way I'm gazing upon my child at some point. And he must have loved me and wanted to do a good job. And he just couldn't. He just was impaired. And so he somehow forgave his father just by the power of his love for his own child. And there were quite a few essays that we considered for the book that were variations on that theme of coming to terms with a difficult relationship with a father and coming to some sort of forgiveness or acceptance of, you know, when they weren't really there or didn't do a very good job.
I am reminded of the essay written by Doug Andrews called The Best Legacy I Can Leave. That essay is about the sad reality that his father committed suicide and his father before him also committed suicide.
Oh, my goodness.
And Doug Andrews trying to come to terms with that reality and trying to sort out how he could chart a different course for himself that would not end up with that same tragic end.
Yeah, that's quite a powerful essay. His greatest legacy that he can leave for his children, both his father and his grandfather killed themselves in the same way by asphyxiating themselves in the garage. And so his big thing is to just keep the garage door open, you know, and not let the darkness and challenges of life overwhelm him so that he will leave that legacy for his children. So, yes, there are echoes of that in several other essays, that notion that, you know, I'm going to break whatever that cycle is in my family, whether it's, you know, in this case, suicide or alcoholism or, there are quite a few parents who have had to really explore, you know, things like corporal punishment. You know, well, you know, my father used to give me a licking and his father gave him a licking and by God, I'm going to do the same thing for my kids. And then maybe you reconsider that or maybe put it in a different context that, you know, there's basically, it seems like two truisms about parenthood. And that is people do exactly what was done to them or they do 180 degrees different what was done to them. You know, by God, I'm never going to do that to my kid. So it's very interesting to see the variations on those two philosophies borne out in these various essays where, you know, especially if it was a very good relationship and there was great wisdom imparted, then you've got a blueprint for what to do yourself when the time comes to be a parent. And when it wasn't so good, you perhaps have a blueprint that you can sort of look at in reverse. Here are the things I won't do or I would rather not do.
We're speaking with Dan Gettemann. We're talking about a marvelous collection of essays stemming from the series This I Believe, this book called This I Believe on Fatherhood. And I don't know if we've made this clear yet, but this is, I think we've at least said it once, that this is not a collection of essays written either by fathers or sons, but that this is a collection which includes the writing of daughters.
Absolutely.
and also certain essays which touch on even when fathering is not done by one's father in particular.
That's right.
In fact, one of my favorite essays in the book, maybe my favorite essay actually in some respects, is an essay about a situation where the father essentially made himself absent. Mm-hmm. And became completely absent, and this woman's three sons,
yes,
ended up being fathered by very important men in,
right,
their life. Michelle Weldon.
Michelle Weldon, yes. We actually had her. We did an event in Chicago with Bob Edwards, a live event with WBEZ, the public radio station there, not too far away from you.
Right.
Last year, and Michelle was one of the people who read her essay live at the event and had all of those men who had been her father, her children's father figures in the audience, along with her boys. It was very powerful. Yes, she talks about how each of her boys was in essence fathered by various people in their lives, sports coaches, uncles, friends of the family, all of whom had sort of risen to the occasion of providing what these boys needed in terms of male role models and guidance and, in some case, discipline, so that they could, you know, it's a truism that, you know, it's very helpful to have a parent of the same gender to bounce things off of and teach you how to do things and teach you how to not do things. And when you are a single parent and you are without that other parent to help guide those children in those ways, then you have to sort of improvise, you know. And much has been written about the negative effects of, you know, a generation or two of boys that have been raised without their fathers and how that, you know, can then perhaps lead them toward, you know, other kinds of associations, you know, most tragically perhaps street gangs, you know, where they can't get that sort of, you know, male energy that they might get from positive people in their lives, so they get it in some negative way. So, yes, she does a beautiful job of celebrating these men that were in her children's lives,
right,
or that are in her children's lives. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a perfect example of an essay in this book that sort of defies necessarily the stereotype of what you think of when you think of fathers.
Dan Gettemann, well-known public radio announcer, contributor, reporter, part of the This I Believe series, which is now a popular podcast, and the editor of this book called This I Believe on Fatherhood. I'm Gregory Berg.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Carthage College's Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. It's coming up on 9 o'clock. At 9:01, we'll have news from NPR. Then we will join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Let's check the forecast now from the National Weather Service. Today, cloudy and seasonal.